From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense, political talk without the boring parts. Today, Katha Pollitt talks about France banning the burkini from the beach. French officials say the ban is a blow against the subjugation of Muslim women. Katha has a different view. Also, the state of the working class and the labor movement this Labor Day weekend. Harold Meyerson will comment. But first, Dr. Jill Stein is the Green Party candidate for president. She holds the current record for the most votes ever received by a woman candidate for president of the U.S. in the general election. She's a mother, an organizer, a physician, and she's a pioneering environmental health advocate. Jill Stein, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, John.
Well, I should tell you, I voted green in one presidential election. I think you probably know which one, 2000. In 2000, I didn't want to support a conservative Democrat, so I voted green. You will remember that Bush officially carried Florida by 500 votes, while 100,000 people like me voted for the Green Party candidate, Ralph Nader. A lot of people, of course, blame the Green Party for Bush becoming president and taking us into a war in Iraq. I have a lot of friends who say, Jill Stein has great ideas. Jill Stein is a wonderful person. But they don't want something like that to happen again this year. What do you say to those people?
Well, one thing to say to them is that if Al Gore had been able to win his home state, then people wouldn't be, you know, complaining about Florida. And if you wanted to silence the Greens because we are a voice of political opposition, you would have to have silenced every other progressive political party that also earned at least that margin of difference in Florida. So let me just say, the answer to a wounded, desperate democracy on life support, the answer to this crisis is not less democracy. We need to have vibrant political opposition. One way we could solve this in the blink of an eye is to pass a voting reform called ranked choice voting. It's a win-win. It's a no-brainer. We already use it in cities across the country and countries around the world. It lets you rank your choice for president. So that way we can actually bring our values to our vote, because how can you have a democracy if you're just voting for who you are just voting against, who you're most afraid of? Democracy needs an affirmative agenda. It needs a moral compass to guide it forward. Why not have the best of both worlds? Let's vote our values and let's create that small voting reform. We could even do it now on an emergency basis and ensure that a voter can go to the polls and rank their choices, knowing if your number one loses, your vote is automatically reassigned to your second choice. And I'll just say, the first time I ran for office in Massachusetts, running against Mitt Romney for governor back in 2002, we filed this bill with a progressive Democratic legislator to ensure that there would be no unintended consequences of your vote. The Democrats, who control that legislature enormously, will not let that bill out of committee. Even 16 years later, what does that tell you? They rely on fear to intimidate your vote because they are not on your side. That alone should be enough to lose them the power of your vote. We have to put our feet down and start building our power, because it's not getting better. It is a race to the bottom between the greater and the lesser evil. Certainly since Bush, Nader, Gore, it has continued. And with all the crisis of the war that Bush led us into, there are indicators, and Gore himself has said that he supported that policy, actually. It's not clear that he would have done something different. And furthermore, Obama had the opportunity to change direction with two Democratic houses of Congress, but he only plunged headlong. You know, the surge into Afghanistan, actually dug his heels in and tried not to get us out of Iraq, and was forced to do that because of a deadline imposed by George Bush by concluding the defense of U.S. forces who would then become liable for their crimes in Iraq. So he was forced to pull out. But in the meantime, you know, we've got expanding war all over the place. It is a bipartisan disaster. We need to challenge that at all levels in order to take a new direction.
The left has argued for decades in the United States about whether it's better to fight inside the Democratic Party or outside the Democratic Party. Bernie Sanders, his whole life was outside the Democratic Party. This year, for the first time, he ran in the Democratic primaries, and he got 13 million votes, far more than any third party on the left outside the Democratic Party has ever gotten. Doesn't that show that progressives have much more success when they run inside the Democratic Party?
But what, you know, where did these, what was the impact of these 13 million votes? I think what we've learned is that you can't have a revolutionary campaign in a counter-revolutionary party. We saw how the Democratic Party, the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, the emails showed how they actually sabotaged Bernie Sanders' campaign, colluded with the Clinton campaign and with members of the corporate media in order to steeply tilt the playing field against Bernie Sanders. And this wasn't just something that happened to Bernie. You know, this has been the rule, not the exception, for every true revolutionary, every true campaign for real change. They've all been sabotaged, whether you look at Dennis Kucinich, who got redistricted by the Democrats along with the Republicans, whether you look at Jesse Jackson, who was also sabotaged by a PR smear campaign, or Dean, Howard Dean, for that matter, not necessarily a progressive, but certainly a peace candidate, who was sabotaged with the Dean Scream, a completely concocted public relations smear campaign. And even now we're learning in our revolution, this living legacy of Bernie's campaign inside the Democratic Party, it's peeling way back. It's not able to support true progressive candidates. You know, this is what that Bernie revolution has devolved to inside the Democratic Party. It never could have gotten started like this without him and without the Democratic Party. And, you know, I think we thank our lucky stars that history has lined up the way it has to enable this jumpstart for real political revolution that has now broken free. On the day that Bernie endorsed Hillary, the floodgates opened into our campaign with Bernie Sanders volunteers, donors, et cetera. And that floodgates, you know, continue to be wide open, and people continue to learn the same lesson. We need an independent political party. The burners aren't going away. They are really committed. You know, the most impassioned and inspired political movement that we've seen in a long time, they now have a permanent political home. It's a marriage made in heaven. I'm seeing it all across the country. And, you know, we ain't seen nothing yet.
One last thing. My friends say Jill Stein has great ideas. Jill Stein is a terrific person. But Donald Trump is a unique challenge and problem. Gary Young, for example, who was a columnist at The Nation, wrote, we need to distinguish between political opponents who are merely bad and those who represent an existential threat to democratic rights. Mitt Romney was bad. It's a good thing he didn't become president. But Trump is of a different order entirely, quoting from Gary Young. His election would represent a paradigmatic shift in what is possible for the American right. Do you agree with that assessment of Trump's candidacy?
I certainly join those who will not sleep well at night if Donald Trump is elected. But I also join those who will not sleep well if Hillary Clinton is elected. In my view, these are both lethal campaigns that very much threaten our future. And as despicable as the things are that Donald Trump says, Hillary Clinton has an extremely troubling and disastrous record, including plunging us headlong into Libya, a charge that she led, approving of the war in Iraq, wanting to start a no-fly zone over Syria, which amounts to basically war with Russia in the air. We are two armed nuclear powers with 2,000 nuclear weapons on hair trigger alert. I'm not going to sleep good with Hillary Clinton as commander-in-chief either. And I'd say, remember this, the majority of Donald Trump's supporters do not actually support Donald Trump. They are motivated by not liking Hillary Clinton. And the news gives us more every day to be worried about the culture of influence that Hillary Clinton represents. In the Clinton Foundation, as we've seen in her emails, et cetera, people are very worried about where we're going under Hillary Clinton. So, you know, in my view, We are not limited to two choices here. And let's give all those reluctant Trump supporters something else to be for. We still have enough time in this election for some profound things to happen. Remember, there are 43 million young people and not so young people who are trapped in predatory student loan debt. If word gets out that they can actually come out and vote for the one candidate, and you're listening to her right now, who will actually cancel that debt like we did for the crooks on Wall Street, for a much smaller price tag, we can cancel the debt of young people, which creates basically the stimulus package of our dreams, liberates a generation that does not have a future. In my experience, when they hear about our campaign, they don't just say, oh, I'll vote for you. It's like suddenly they are missionaries on a religious mission to tell everybody they know. If 43 million people in debt, let alone a family member, but just those 43 million, if they come out to vote green to end their debt, that's a winning plurality of the vote. This is not an impossible scenario in this election where every rule in the rule book has already been tossed out. There are ways to imagine not where we split the vote, but where we actually flip the vote. We say, let's get into the debates, support real open debates. We need that if we're going to have even the pretense of a democracy in this election. And let's see where the American people decide to go, because the majority have already spoken. They dislike and distrust Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump at record levels, and they are clamoring for something else. Let's allow democracy to create its healing power, its healing possibilities. Let's let democracy go forward before we foreclose this possibility of actually a progressive solution in this race. We know the votes are out there. Bernie won, hands down, on every head-to-head comparison. There is the potential to win not just Hillary, reluctant Hillary supporters, and not just reluctant Donald Trump supporters, but an entire generation of young people who are tending to sit this one out because they don't see a future for themselves in either of these establishment political campaigns.
I should just add that at The Nation magazine, John Nichols has called for opening the debates to the independent candidates because they have good ideas that we need to hear. My favorite of the Jill Stein good ideas, in addition to canceling student debt, is the Green New Deal. Tell us about the Green New Deal.
So the Green New Deal is an emergency jobs program to solve not only our economic emergency, but also to solve our climate emergency. Because in fact, we do have two emergencies. The recovery has largely been restricted to those at the top. Workers now are still making wages that are barely above poverty. And the jobs that have come back are low-wage, part-time, insecure, temporary jobs. So most people are struggling economically, and we're never going to solve the climate crisis unless it is fundamentally a job solution as well. So the climate crisis, on the other hand, you know, we're seeing in the headlines now the fires on the West Coast, the floods in Louisiana. Every month is a new record world-high temperature for the month of that name. And the science is now telling us we could see 9 feet of sea level rise as soon as 2050, which will be a civilization-ending development. So we need to act now if we're going to prevent that. We've got two emergencies. The Green New Deal is one fell swoop to address both of them. Creates 20 million jobs. It's sort of a New Deal-type solution, except that these are focused on an emergency transition to a green economy with 100% clean renewable energy by 2030, which is what the science tells us we need to do if we're actually going to fix this. But we can do that. We also call for a healthy food system, local, organic, sustainable food systems, which are good for us as well as good for the planet, good for the climate, good for farm workers. And we call for public transportation, renewably powered, that dovetails with recreational transportation so we can bike and walk safely to transit hubs. This is essentially the stimulus package of our dreams. It will achieve not only 100% renewables by 2030, we also call for an immediate ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure and development. It'll revive the economy, it'll turn the tide on climate change, and it makes the wars for oil obsolete, which is part of how we pay for this. It enables us to cut this bloated, dangerous military budget, which is eating up more than half of our discretionary budget, about half of our income tax dollars, are paying for these wars, which have only created failed states, mass refugee migrations, and worse terrorist threats. So we need daylight shined on this discussion. That's another reason why I need to be in the debate. I'll be the only one telling the truth about the war. But the Green New Deal enables us to offload this dangerous military budget. We don't need 1,000 bases in 100 countries around the world, basically patrolling our fossil fuel access to other people's energy and the routes of transportation. Instead, we've got that energy here at home, so we can put our military dollars into true security here at home. And the other way we pay for the Green New Deal is that we get so much healthier on fully powered clean renewable energy. We get so much healthier so quickly that the savings in healthcare alone is enough to pay for the green energy transition. That means less asthma, less cancers, heart attacks, and strokes. And with the healthy food component of this, it means less of that diabetes and obesity epidemics that we're also paying for with, you know, with health, with survival, you know, with our tax dollars as well, for the inordinate cost. $3 trillion a year we are paying for not health care, but basically sick care, in a sick care system that's trying to compensate for how this predatory food system, this predatory energy system, and this chaos of a transportation system, which is passive, all make us sick and contribute the boatload of the cost. The vast majority of these $3 trillion are spent on diseases that are absolutely avoidable if we were doing the right thing up front. So the Green New Deal is a win-win-win all around, including that it pays for itself.
One last question, the experience question. A lot of my friends say Jill Stein has great ideas, but she has no experience as an elected official. Hillary has a lifetime of experience, and therefore she's more able to deal with all the problems of what politics is, the art of the possible. What do you say about the experience question?
Well, it's true. I definitely do not have experience of taking money from the predatory banks, from the fossil fuel giants, from the war profiteers, from the insurance companies. So yes, I come to this as a physician, not a politician, but I also come to this as an activist, and I have plenty of experience helping to build coalitions of ordinary citizens in order to get things done as citizen activists. And that includes cleaning up our coal plants in Massachusetts, where I was part of the leadership of that campaign. It includes shutting down toxic incinerators and environmental racism, which is poisonous to everybody, but particularly communities of color. I had a lot of experience passing campaign finance reform in Massachusetts, which we passed as a voter referendum. And guess who repealed it? The guys with all that experience in our legislature. We, the voters, passed it as a referendum, and those experienced politicians took away campaign finance reform and public funding. And mind you, this was the Democratic legislature, 85% Democratic, which said to me in no uncertain terms that change will not come not only from the predators in politics, but it will not come from the Democratic Party. I've actually served approximately 5 years on my town meeting in Lexington, but I have served much longer watchdogging our democracy, watchdogging Congress, watchdogging my legislature in Massachusetts, so that we, the people, actually get a word in edgewise. People say, aren't you afraid of Donald Trump? Yes, I'm afraid of Donald Trump, but I'm really afraid of climate change. I'm afraid of war under Hillary Clinton or under Donald Trump. I'm afraid of expanding nuclear weapons and nuclear confrontation. That is not going to be solved by either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. Let's let democracy go forward. Let's have the real debate here, and let's allow the American people to decide, and let's give those reluctant Trump voters someone else that they can support who's actually on their side, who's not sending their jobs overseas, who's not cheating on their workers, who's not rooking their students and misleading their students and cheating them out of their tuition. we can have an America and a future that works for all of us. We have to forget this propaganda of the lesser evil and fight for the greater good like our lives depend on it. The minute we do that, the minute we stand up with the courage of our convictions, we can then see the reality that we actually have the numbers here to win the day. We can do that on the power of student debt alone.
Jill Stein, she's the Green Party candidate for president. Jill, thanks so much for coming in today. It's been great having you.
Really great talking with you, John.
Now it's time for Burkini Radio. For that, we turn to Katha Pollitt, poet, essayist, and award-winning columnist for The Nation magazine. Her most recent book is Pro Reclaiming Abortion Rights. It's out now in paperback. We reached her today in Connecticut. Hi, Katha.
Hi, John. I feel like I should be wearing a bathing suit.
Well, several cities in France along the Riviera have banned the burkini, and then a French court said they couldn't do it, but now it's become a political issue there. It's going to be a political issue in France for the coming season. The burkini is a form of swimwear for Muslim women who follow the Quran's injunction to cover and be modest in dress. It's a long-sleeve tunic with pants and a hood. It's 100% polyester. It's lightweight and quick-drying. It provides UV protection. The burkini leaves only the face, hands, and feet visible. The socialist prime minister of France, Manuel Valls, called the burkini, quote, a symbol of the enslavement of women, close quote. I wonder if you agree.
No, I don't agree. I think there are a lot of things that are symbolic of the enslavement of women, if you wanted to go that route. But I think what France is doing is both, at this point, disingenuous, ineffective, and cruel. You know, when all this banning of Muslim dress started, the rationale was partly, oh, well, women are being, schoolgirls are being forced into the hijab and women are being forced into niqabs and burqas or whatever. And so we have to protect them by making a law against these things. It turns out that these fears were quite overblown. I mean, not to say that it never happens, but it's not the main reason why women, Muslim women, want to wear religious dress. They want to wear religious dress because they're religious.
So what do you make of the injunction to women to be, quote, modest? It's not just the Orthodox Muslims, but also Jews and some Christians see the female body as a danger and a provocation to men. They say it's not a good idea for women to provoke men to unclean thoughts.
Oh, I know. Well, this is the flip side of it, which is that, you know, the idea of modesty is so gendered. I mean, for example, men don't have to wear a face veil. Men don't have to wear a burkini. And you often see couples or families on the beach where the woman is dressed in some religious cover up and the man is dressed like a normal person in a Speedo on the beach, or men go around with their shirts off all the time. And, you know, that it's the idea you must provoke men. But nobody thinks, well, you mustn't provoke women. What about that? Nobody cares about that because it's all about controlling women's bodies, whether it's you have to show something or you can't show something. And that's what's wrong with the whole thing.
We saw news photos last week. I think it was on the beach in Nice, four French policemen in bulletproof vests with guns at their hips, appearing to force a Muslim woman to remove an aqua tunic that covered her arms and hips. Really ugly.
Oh, I thought that was so shocking. And I do think that is one of the reasons why this issue turned around a little bit in France, because it was it just went totally viral, that photograph. And what you saw was this rather rotund, middle-aged looking woman who was taking a nap on the beach, and she's forced to remove this very ordinary garment, not a burkini, not a religious garment, And she's forced at gunpoint to take off her clothes. I mean, this is really crazy, especially when you consider that, you know, if you go back a couple of decades, the police would have been there forcing people to put more clothes on. But it was so cruel, so heartless, so humiliating. And I just don't understand what the French think they are going to accomplish by this. I mean, they do have a problem. They have a problem with segregation. They have a problem with Muslims not being able to get jobs, with them being confined, shunted off in these terrible suburbs that it's very hard to get transportation out of, et cetera, et cetera. That's their problem. Their problem is that people need to be educated. People need to be integrated into society. People need to be protected with laws against discrimination. Forcing people to wear or not wear certain clothes is going to have the opposite effect.
Many French people would also say they have another problem, a problem of terrorism.
Well, yes, there is that. And I think it's probably not an accident that these bans really took off on the Riviera after there were two, you know, terrible acts of terrorism earlier this summer. When that truck driver ran amok and killed 84 people and injured a whole lot more. And then when a priest was killed in the north of France. But I just don't see how fetishizing a religious garment is going to have any positive effect of any kind. And it's certainly not going to stop terrorism.
Well, the defenders of the French ban on the burkini make at least a couple of arguments beyond the idea that it's a symbol of the enslavement of women. Let me try these out on you. The first is what we could call the when in Rome argument. If you were in Saudi Arabia and going to the beach, would you go topless? No, because you respect their culture. So they in quotes, should have the same respect for French culture when they're in France that we have for their culture when we're in the Persian Gulf. What do you think of the when in Rome argument?
Well, I think when you're visiting Rome, it's wise to show respect for the customs of Rome. When you live in Rome, when you're raising children in Rome, when you're a citizen of Rome, then it's a little different. Then the question becomes more, well, what should the rules be? How should one live in Rome? The analogy you're making assumes that these Muslims, millions of Muslims who have made their home in France for many decades, and who many of whom came from Algeria, which was a French colony, where the French colonists certainly didn't live like the Algerians were living. But the point is, these people are just as much citizens of France as I'm a citizen of the United States.
Another argument, we could call it the slippery slope argument. First, they, in quotes, they demand the right to wear burkinis. Next, they'll demand separate beach areas for men and women. And then they'll say, we will not allow our sons to be taught in French schools by women whose heads are uncovered. Where does it stop if not nipped in the bud now? That's actually a quote from a letter published in the New York Times. What do you think of the slippery slope argument?
I generally don't like slippery slope arguments because it implies that you can't stop, whereas, of course, you can. For example, abortion is permitted up to a certain time and not thereafter. You're allowed to put your sick cat to sleep, but you're not allowed to torture it to death. I mean, you know, so in this case, I would say that to say that somebody can wear what they want on the beach is a permission. It is not the same as saying you can't go to this part of the beach if you're a man, or you can't go to this part of the beach if you're a woman. It's not the same as saying you have to wear a hijab if you want to teach my son in a public school. These are all very different things. And I think it is a liberal, secular, and humane thing that gives everybody freedom to say you can wear what you want on the beach. Somebody wearing a burkini does not take away my right to wear my little one piece or a bikini, should I choose to do that, which I'm not going to do.
Okay. So the purpose of modesty rules is to avoid provoking men, but the mayor of Cannes has said repeatedly that the burkini is, quote, a provocation. It seems like whatever you do, men are provoked. I'm so confused.
Well, you're a man. You'll have to take it up with yourself. But no, it's completely true. It's all controlling women's dress is all about men. And I think men really need to think a little harder about why they are so obsessed with what women are wearing.
Well, the burkini ban is, although it's been voided by a high court in France, it's going to be defended by the conservative candidate for Prime Minister Sarkozy in the coming elections. And of course, it's not the only proposal about Muslim women's appearance in public that's currently on the agenda in France. What else can you tell us is now required of Muslim women and what's been proposed?
The latest thing is some politicians want the hijab to be banned from the universities.
Yes.
Up till now, it's been banned from public schools. And this here again is it's saying, you know, well, if you want to wear a headscarf, you can't get a higher education. So is the idea to create this class of religious women who will be less educated, less able to get a job, more, you know, more forced into an immigrant community with fewer ways to expand their world and to be independent? Because that's what it's really all about. You know, all this stuff about women, it's really all about how independent can a woman be? Well, a woman who can't get a job and a woman who doesn't have any education, the chances of her being an independent person are much less than if she has access to those social benefits. It's not just about what you wear. It's the consequences for Muslim women of these bans on religious dress. If you wear a hijab, just the headscarf, you cannot get a government job because the government is supposed to be a religion-free zone. And, you know, if you're thinking of how to include people, how to make them more part of a secular society, then letting women work at government jobs, which in France is an enormous sector of the economy, it includes daycare centers, for example, then it's really counterproductive. What it does is it further excludes Muslim women from the larger society.
If you wanted to help women escape the subjugation of Orthodox religion, Katha, where would you start?
I think you have to do a lot of things. And I think secular education is really important. I think making contacts outside those narrow communities is very important. I mean, there are, for example, in London, there are Orthodox Jewish sects where the kids basically don't learn English. They have an entirely religious education conducted in Yiddish. Well, by the time you're a teenager and you're beginning to think, hey, maybe this isn't for me, you have an awful lot of catching up to do. And those ultra-Orthodox sects also preach, you know, women are for cooking and cleaning and bearing children, that's it. And in some, they're not even supposed to drive. There's a rabbi who has said women shouldn't go to college. You know, so it isn't just Islam. Here's another really good example is the Amish in America were given by the Supreme Court the right to pull their kids out of school after the eighth grade, which they wanted to do because the more education you get, the less likely you are to want to be an Amish farmer for your entire life. The more likely you are to ask questions and the more opportunity you have to do other things. So I think that was a very misguided ruling. I think that parents should not be able to close off their children from the larger world in that way. In the United States, we seem to be more and more interpreting religious freedom to mean the freedom to override the normal rules of society. And I think that's really a mistake.
One closing thought. While France continues to debate banning the burkini and the headscarf and other forms of religious clothing for women, other countries have taken a different route. In Canada, instead of banning the headscarf, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, famed for their red serge tunics and their broad-brimmed felt hats, announced this summer that female officers will be allowed to wear the hijab, the headscarf. The Mounties have allowed Sikhs to wear the turban of their faith since 1990. Why can't we all be like the Mounties?
Yeah, in the immortal words of Rodney King, why can't we all just get along? I mean, who is harmed if a Mountie wears a hijab or a turban? Really? Nobody. And you see, you know, it's like Orthodox Jewish men wear a yarmulke. Who is harmed by that? Nobody.
Katha Pollitt, her new column in The Nation is about the battle over the burkini. Thank you, Katha.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This weekend is Labor Day, America's official answer to May Day, the day to celebrate workers' revolution. On Labor Day weekend, it's traditional to contemplate the state of the labor movement and the working man and woman in the country today. And so we turn to Harold Meyerson. He's executive editor of the American Prospect and a regular contributor to the LA Times and other publications. We reached him today in our nation's capital. Harold, welcome back.
Always good to be here, John.
Well, let's start with some good news about the labor movement in America. California is a place where the Democrats control the state government, and California has had some very good news for labor. As we tape today, we've just heard the news that the California legislature passed the Farm Workers Overtime Bill, which was a huge struggle. Tell us about that.
Well, it was a struggle because, as you pointed out, even though the Democrats have almost two-thirds of the votes in each house of the legislature, they had trouble getting this bill through the assembly. In fact, the first time it came up in June, it didn't get a majority. It was three votes short. What happens is that a lot of the Democrats from agricultural areas, perhaps perversely, respond to the pressure of agribusiness rather than the farm workers. But this time around, the farm workers themselves demonstrated. They had considerable support from the Speaker of the Assembly, Anthony Rendon. And the bill passed. It had already passed the state Senate, which is a more liberal body. The bill passed this Monday, actually, in the legislature, and now it goes on to Jerry Brown.
So this bill will help more than 825,000 workers. They will get time and a half pay for working more than 8 hours in a day or more than 40 hours in a week. They will get double pay for working more than 12 hours a day. This isn't going to happen right now. It's going to be incremental over 4 years. There's another weird provision that the governor could suspend overtime pay for a year if the economy falters. So obviously some compromises were made along the way here.
Yeah, well, they had to pick up those extra votes that they didn't have in June. And so they did, in fact, create some exceptions here and exceptions there. But really what I think this demonstrates in a larger sense is the whole non-universal fragmentary nature of what we think of as the American welfare state, something that on a national level, Benira Katznelson has written about so well in his book on the New Deal, pointing out that the right to unionize and the right to collect Social Security and all these things, when they were enacted in the 1930s, excluded farm workers, domestic workers, etc., because it needed the votes at that point of Southern representatives and senators, just as the bill which just passed in Sacramento needed some votes from agricultural areas in order to pass. And so, you know, the down and out of society come late to the standards which the rest of the country enjoys, like the overtime standard. But at least in California, for agricultural workers, now those standards have been equalized.
Continuing to look at what's happened in California for the working class on this coming Labor Day weekend, California raised the statewide minimum wage to $15, again, incrementally until 2022. How significant is that?
Oh, it's huge. It affects millions of California workers. California, particularly Southern California, is an economy that really the middle has fallen out of that economy, not the bottom. When aerospace really downsized at the end of the Cold War, many of the middle-income jobs in California just evaporated along with it. At the same time, you had huge migration and a large number of low-wage service sector jobs were created, whose pay has been stagnant for a long time. And so first the cities in California, the big liberal cities, first San Francisco, then Los Angeles, passed a $15 minimum wage provision. And then the state followed. And this was something that Jerry Brown signed. And it's something that is going on in liberal cities and states across the nation. California raised its minimum wage to $15 within the 48 hours of the time that New York raised its minimum wage to $15, both of them to be phased in over a number of years. So the gridlock at the federal level is being countered in states where there is a liberal government at the state level. Although I should point out on the day we're doing this interview that it recently passed in the New Jersey state legislature. But today, Tuesday, Chris Christie vetoed the $15 minimum wage in New Jersey.
Shows the reason not to have Republicans in state power, which is...
Not to mention Chris Christie being the head of the, God forbid, Trump transition team. So yes. keep that in mind as well.
California, where the Democrats have almost two-thirds majorities in both houses of the legislature and every state elected office, California also extended paid family leave and established paid sick days. These seem like complicated, maybe small things, but they're not small things, are they?
No, they're not small things at all. And this is one of those areas where the nation as a whole lags behind every other nation on earth, with, I think, the exception of Papua New Guinea and Oman. Which do have paid family leave and paid sick day. We have, you know, in some sense, the most cruel, unmitigated form of capitalism, which grants workers fewer rights than anywhere else. But again, as with the minimum wage, a few states have gotten out ahead on paid sick leave and paid family leave. Connecticut and California lead the pack there. And again, there are cities where in states where cities have the power to do this, like in California, San Francisco got out, again, ahead of the state on this. So there's definitely a pattern of federalism, to a degree justifying Louis Brandeis's famous assessment of states as laboratories of democracy, although in some cases, in this day and age, it's more cities, which tend to be more progressive than states, that are the real laboratories of democracy.
So the things we've talked about for California workers, overtime pay for farm workers, higher minimum wage, paid family leave, paid sick days, these all have to do with pay. California has also done something tremendously important for its working class and poor people. It's gone farther than almost any state in the adoption of Obamacare and in the expansion of Medi-Cal for poor people. This is also a huge accomplishment for a Democratic-controlled state.
It is, at a time when, frankly, Obamacare is in some trouble because the major health insurance companies aren't hitting their profit margins, and so Aetna was recently one that bailed out in most states from being in the Obamacare market. California's been expanding it and trying to expand it to immigrants and even undocumented immigrants, which is really a reflection of California's two things, of California's demographics, but also of the degree to which the Latino community and other communities in California have won a level of political power that they don't really have in other states. And so that's reflected in the expansion of Medicaid and those kinds of programs in California. I might add, you know, a lot of that is the high level of representation of Latinos and other minorities in the legislature, and that's kind of an unintended consequence of term limits. If the state didn't have term limits, there would be a number of very old white guys still as a majority in the legislature, but such is not the case, and the legislature is a highly diverse body, much more reflective of the actual population of the state.
We've been talking about the Democrats, the Democratic Party, doing all these things, but hasn't it really been a small number of big labor unions that have really pushed these things and make them happen in California?
Well, they've certainly promoted them, yes. Although I must say the overtime for farm workers was promoted by a very small and not very wealthy union at all, the United Farm Workers,
yes.
Which has tremendous symbolic power, but actually a rather small membership and really no treasury to speak of. But a lot, certainly a lot of the Fight for 15 has been backed by California's largest union, the Service Employees International Union, which has about 2 million members nationally, but 700,000 of them are in California. So it is the 800-pound, 700,000 member gorilla of California politics, and it has been the real push behind the Fight for 15 all over the country, and they should get tremendous credit for that, particularly since this has not been a campaign that has engendered any new members, but it has managed to raise the standards for low-wage workers in really all over the country, because while there are lots of states that haven't raised a wage to $15, some have raised it to $10, some have raised it to $11, and you have employers like Walmart, which raised their wage to, I think, $10 an hour. So it's had really a tremendous effect for workers all across the country, even though this campaign has cost SEIU a ton of money without, as I said, bringing in one more dollar in dues membership fees.
So California is important not only as a laboratory for democracy, but just because it has such a huge population and such a huge economy. We are told now California has gone from being the eighth largest economy in the world to the sixth largest economy in the world. A lot of California chauvinism out here about that. So this is helping truly millions of people. But maybe there's good news for the working class outside of California, elsewhere in the United States, on this Labor Day weekend?
Well, there are certainly states that have done progressive things. As I mentioned, New York raised its minimum wage to $15.
Yes.
At the national level, anything that has to go through Congress hasn't moved at all since the Republicans took Congress in 2011. But the Obama administration has gotten really a lot of progress for workers out of both Labor Department rulings and National Labor Relations Board rulings recently. Just in the last week, in a really landmark decision, the National Labor Relations Board overturned a previous ruling that the Bush National Labor Relations Board had instituted in 2004. And what happened this past week was that the National Labor Relations Board said that graduate students at private universities who are employed as teaching assistants or research assistants can, in fact, unionize. This was a case brought by the grad students at Columbia University, my alma mater. And the court said that, if it works like a duck, it's probably a worker, you know, like any other duck. And they said that these folks can unionize. But the AFL-CIO estimated that there are probably 100,000 TAs and RAs around the country who could therefore join unions. And there's a slew of unions that have been trying to organize graduate students. Oddly enough, in the Northeast around Columbia, the most active union has been the United Auto Workers, which has a tradition of representing some university employees in that part of the country. But it was really a signal victory for an important part of intellectual working class.
Last thing we should contemplate here as Labor Day weekend approaches is the dark side of the American working class, and that, of course, is membership in unions.
Right. Well, we don't have the figures yet for the last year, but over the last half century, it's fallen from about a third of the workforce to about 11% of the workforce. And in the private sector, it's fallen from over 40% of the workforce to under 7%. And so that's a huge problem. And the Economic Policy Institute has just come out with a study today, Tuesday, showing that the effect of the declining rate of unionization over this time period has been to reduce the average wage of working class men by over $2,000 over the last several decades. So it's one of the major contributory factors to the evisceration and the steady erosion of the American middle class.
Harold Meyerson in Washington. Happy Labor Day, Harold.
Happy Labor Day to you, John.
Start Making Sense, the Nation podcast, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books. Our senior producer at Start Making Sense is Alan Minsky. Our executive producer is Frank Reynolds. Our recording engineer is Ernesto Orellano. Our engagement editor is Annie Shields. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. Find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense wherever you get your podcasts, at Stitcher, SoundCloud, or iTunes. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.